first, Earl, we wanted to talk about WLAG and what you know about the old WLAG station, how that got started, and the transition from WLAG to WCCO.
Well, WLAG was a 500-watt radio station, one of a few in the country, and the studios and transmitter were located in the Oak Grove Hotel. And it was sponsored by a group of businessmen and others in Minneapolis and St. Paul. I remember the Dakota Farmer, I believe, was one of the active sponsoring organizations. And there were a good many people in the Twin Cities had crystal sets. There had been other stations, one operated by the Minneapolis Tribune, one by the Dayton Company. But those had gone by the boards, and WLAG, which was known as the Call of the North, later objected to by the Civic and Commerce Association because of the feeling that people would hear that and think we lived in the frozen North, stayed on the air. But they had a bad time financially, as there was no income except donations. In the early summer of 1924, the Northwest Radio Trade Association, which was made up of people who sold radio sets, realized that unless they could keep a station going, there would be no market for sets. They hired a man named Harry Wilburn, who was a well-known publicity man and promoter in Minneapolis, to raise funds. He went all through the city soliciting until he came to the offices of Washburn Crosby Company. He told Donald D. Davis, then I believe vice president or secretary of the company, what his plans were. Mr. Davis talked it over with Mr. James Ford Bell, the president of the company, and they decided that they might just as well take the whole thing on themselves. So they finally made the deal and bought the WLAG from the people that owned it for $7,500. And in September, the call letters were changed to WCCO, which stood for Washburn Crosby Company.
Earl, do you recall any discussions or anything which led up to the idea of using the call letters and the Washburn Crosby Company together?
No, except that it was felt, of course, by the Washburn Crosby people that the ultimate aim of the station would be to advertise the company and sell gold medal flour, although there were no commercial programs at that time.
There were on the old WLAG station, as I understand it, they didn't sell commercials or didn't have any revenue.
No, we had no income except the donation from the subscribers. After Washburn Crosby bought it, they had a deal set up whereby the Minneapolis Civic and Commerce Association paid, I think, something like 60% of the expenses in a year, and the St. Paul Association was to pay the other 40%. And that deal ran for a little over a year and finally dropped out because the St. Paul group felt that they were not getting their share of the advertising. In fact, we were so careful in those days that in front of the announcer, who was Paul Johnson, the only one we had a card. On one side it said Minneapolis, St. Paul, and on the other side, St. Paul, Minneapolis. And that card had to be turned over after every announcement to make sure the right city was mentioned an equal number of times first.
You might be interested to know, Earl, that we still have that same problem in 1964.
Well, I remember the night that the St. Paul Association decided they would have no more part of us. And they were going to have a station over there, which they later became KSDP. And they telephoned the news to me while I was in the dentist chair having a bridge put in about 5:30 one afternoon.
Earl, within the old Washburn Crosby Company, Donald Davis, I think, is referred to as the father of WCCO, or the fellow responsible for WCCO.
Yes, he was the man that was very much in favor of it. Mr. Will Bovey, who was the superintendent of the mills and one of the directors of the company, was also always interested in radio, and he took quite an active part, more from the technical side. But Mr. Davis was one who saw the possibilities of radio all the way through.
Did you have any estimate as to the number of listeners or the number of crystal sets or radio sets that were available in that time?
Yes, and we had probably the most unusual and inadvertent survey made in spring of 1925 when I believe Coolidge was inaugurated. And we at that time had become members of the National Broadcasting Company hookup. There were 30-some stations on it, and they gave the call letters of each one when they went on the air. I can always remember that because Washburn Crosby was quite put out because they wouldn't say the Gold Medal Flower Station. But we went on the air with the inaugural program, the first one, after we had gone out to the new transmitter at Anoka, which was then 5,000 watts, which was super power. And for some reason or other, nobody thought to check whether the crystal sets in the Twin Cities could get this station, which they couldn't. We went on there after all this advertising and ballyhoo about the inaugural program. We went on the morning with the big show. And it was estimated that 15,000 crystal set owners in the Twin Cities couldn't hear a sound. And I think they all tried to telephone the station.
You got too far out for the crystal set.
Yeah.
Earl, when did they acquire the site out there at Anoka for the transmitting site?
That was in 1924 and first of 1925. And Mr. Will Bovey handled the purchase of that for Washburn Crosby Company, and he bought the site on the basis that he was going to have a big chicken farm out there.
Been a lot of eggs laid out here since that time, hasn't there? Earl, how long did Washburn Crosby operate the station?
They operated until 1929, when Mr. William Paley, president of CBS, came out and offered $450,000 for the property. And he bought a third in 1929 and took option on the other two-thirds to be exercised in 31, which they did exercise. But in 29, CBS took over the management of the station. And Washburn Crosby gave up all contact with us. I remember that year distinctly because it was the first year that the station, we then had commercial programs, it was the first year that the station made any money, but it was a bad year in billing and we all had our salaries cut.
So that the milling year was bad, but the radio year business was good.
Yes, it was just about the first time when we found out there were such possibilities as commercial radio.
Did Washburn Crosby, while they owned the station, have baseball and broadcast baseball with the Wheaties Quartet?
We had the Wheaties Quartet, and that was started out when Mr. Davis and the other directors felt they ought to do something a little more specific to advertise flour and this new product, Wheaties, which had just gone on the market. The quartet was unique. The leading singer was an undertaker. One of the men was a clerk in the courthouse, one a clerk in the grain exchange, and I think the fourth member was a tobacco salesman or something or other. And only one of the members could read music. But they did real well, and they sang 2 half-hour shows a week, I think for $50.
And didn't later, wasn't that Wheaties Quartet picked up by the CBS network?
It was. It was greatly augmented. Eddie Dunstetter played the organ. We brought in other singers and others, and it was fed to the network. It was the first network show fed out of the Twin Cities.
Well, now, Earl, during the time that Washburn Crosby owned the station and operated the station, you were then an employee of the Washburn Crosby Company.
I was until 20 through 29, I'm not sure, possibly until 31 that we were on the Washburn Crosby payroll.
Well, when did you make the, I'm trying to establish here now, when you made the the great decision to leave the Washburn Crosby Company and become a radio executive.
Well, I made that in 25 because although I was pretty cold, as I said, on radio when they bought the station, and I kind of questioned the sanity of some of the directors, I soon became so interested I forgot all about everything but radio.
In other words, your position first on the thing was a rather reserved position with respect to the company's decision to buy a radio station.
Yes, more or less. I went up to handle publicity, and in those days, everything we did was with an eye towards the story we could get in the paper. And we had a very fine classical music program that was run by a lady named Eleanor Paler. She'd been a music teacher and singer in Minneapolis, and I think back to those old days, and she did a terrific job because we didn't have any such things as schedules. Sometimes a program would run over half an hour, and sometimes it'd be cut off in 15 minutes.
Where were the studios, Earl, when the station, when Washburn Crosby first established it?
In the Oak Grove Hotel.
Where the old LIG?
Yes, the old LIG, and in the spring of 1925, when we inaugurated the new transmitter at Anoka, we opened our new studios on the 13th floor of the Nicollet Hotel.
And then those studios stayed there until you
moved? Until we moved over to the old Elks Club.
Well, then, Earl, there was a period there when you were still with Washburn Crosby Company and also the manager of the radio station. Is that right, or working for the radio station?
I was working for the radio station all the time from 25 on to 31. And I think I was on the Washburn Crosby, I'm sure I was on the Washburn Crosby payroll after CBS bought the first third, because, as I told you, our salaries were reduced that first year that we made money.
Well, then, Earl, when did you finally make the complete move as a from Washburn Crosby Company or over to radio and become a full-time radio executive?
Well, I had worked entirely for radio for all those years. Mm-hmm. But in 31, CBS took over the last two-thirds, and Mr. Bellows had been appointed to the Federal Communications Commission in 29, I believe, but was not confirmed and later returned to Minneapolis. And about 30 or 31, he came back to Washington as vice president of the Columbia Broadcasting System. And I stayed in Minneapolis, and I was made vice president and actively in charge of the station in 31.
Oh, this is vice president of CBS.
No, CCO.
Of WCCO.
And then through some changes in arrangements, Mr. Bellows left CBS and came back and worked down at General Mills, and I was made president, manager, or whatever the title was, I've forgotten, of CCO.
Well, then, Mr. Bellows, for a time then, acted as the manager of WCCO. Is that before
yes.
he left for Washington?
Yes.
And you
yes.
were, in effect, working for him?
Yes, I was his assistant.
And then, when he returned, he went back to work for General Mills or the Washburn Crosby Company?
Yes, after he came back from CBS, and that was about 32.
About in 1929, then, I believe you said that CBS acquired the first one-third of the ownership of WCCO.
Yes, I believe that was it.
All right, then enter CBS and WCCO then as partners, and you mentioned a while ago, too, Earl, that at one time WCCO was a NBC affiliate. What happened to the affiliation with NBC?
Been carrying a few commercial programs back in 1928, I believe it was, and Mr. Bellows had succeeded in selling the Minneapolis Symphony Orchestra to the First National Bank on a Sunday night. It was a great thing for the country and the town and the orchestra. He'd no sooner done it than we got word from the NBC Chicago office, where Niall Strammel was then vice president, that they had sold the Standard Oil Company of Indiana, the Chicago Symphony, for a similar program which would come on just ahead of us on Sunday night. And we told them, Mr. Bellows told them, that he would not carry the program. They said that if we didn't carry the program, they would give it to KSDP, which was just getting started and had no network affiliation. Mr. Bellows said that if they gave the program to KSDP, we would begin to take some Columbia Broadcasting System programs, as he knew Mr. Paley and thought he was quite a man and was going places in the field. It finally ended up that NBC asked us to leave, or told us we were off their network, gave all their programs to KSDP. We kept the Minneapolis Symphony on for First National Bank, and we also took the CBS programs, of which the only two I can remember were the Two Black Crows and Paul Whiteman and his orchestra.
At that time, CBS was just a small, insignificant network as compared with the great NBC, wasn't it?
It was, and we had been the only network station up there ever since the networks had started. And for the next year or two, the going was very, very tough for us.
Did Mr. Paley come out to Minneapolis himself? That is, Bill Paley come out to Minneapolis himself to negotiate the purchase of the station with General Mills?
He did. In the original deal in 1929, he came out, made the offer, and closed up the deal. And I believe that General Mills has a recorded program or has had a show in which they described the whole detail.
It seems to me, Earl, that at that time they referred to him as a cigar salesman from New York.
Yeah, well, it's from Philadelphia.
From Philadelphia.
His family owned the La Palina Cigar Company, and he was the sales manager until he got into radio and later into television. His sister told me one time that her brother Bill had been in Europe, and he came back and found that the company had bought some time on a radio network called Columbia. And he wasn't very well satisfied with the idea, but he got into it, became so interested that he decided to buy the network for a very insignificant sum, as we nowadays. And she said that he went around among his relatives, his father and his uncles, brother-in-laws, raising money. She said, we were quite sure he'd lose it all, but we thought if he made the success of the idea, we'd all be very proud of him.
Do you remember the first time that you met Bill Paley, your first contact with him, Earl?
Yes, I met him in Chicago in the offices of WNAQ, which was run by the Daily News and owned then. I met Mr. Paley, and I met George Storr, who's later become one of my best friends. I met them one afternoon there. Mr. Bellows was at that time on the commission, and Bill Hedges and I had a chance to sell his station in Chicago and WCCO in Minneapolis on an hour's program once a week to the Packard Company. To do that, we had to get CBS to give up their time for the Harvester Cigar for a program. And we went down to talk to Mr. Paley, and he agreed to do it if we'd provide another program. And we did, and we put on Oscar Danielson and his Swedish Dance Orchestra. And Oscar did such a fine job that when the Packard contract expired and we were going to take the network program back for Harvester Cigar, the cigar company wanted to keep Oscar.
Mm-hmm. In that connection then, Earl, these were some of the first commercial programs that you had on the station, is that right?
Yes, the first commercial program, of course, was the Wheaties Quartet with General Mills. And as I say in some of their histories, you'll find that when they were about ready to abandon Wheaties, they discovered that in Minneapolis, where they had this radio program, they were selling Wheaties faster than any other place at a lower cost. And they then decided to increase their radio program.
First success story for radio.
Yes. And then our baseball, I can't remember what year it was, but it had been sponsored for several years by the Wirtz Cigar Company. And one summer, in the middle of the summer, Mr. Wirtz told me he had to drop it. Well, I didn't know who he'd sell it to, so I went down and talked to Sam Gale, then the advertising director of General Mills, and Sam thought it might be a good idea for General Mills to have it. And so we went and talked to Mr. Davis, and he said, if you can sell it to Walter Berry and the sales department, I'll go for it. But he says, I think it's an audience just for women in the daytime, or for men, and we're appealing to women and children. Well, we sold them the baseball. Before the season was over, they bought in three or four other towns, and the next year and the year after, they became the biggest buyers of baseball in the country for Wheaties.
One more thing in connection with the General Mills organization. We haven't mentioned James Ford Bell's name in connection with this thing yet. What was Mr. Bell's general attitude toward radio in those days?
Well, I would say he was tolerant.
he was a miller first.
He was a miller. And I used to see, as the last time I saw Mr. Bell was here in Washington at Gridiron Dinner, and we had quite a visit, and I was surprised about the enthusiasm he developed for radio and television in the years.
Earl, it seems to me that along about in the early 30s, we had something known up there as the Depression. How did WCCO go through the Depression years?
Well, it's the funny part. As I said, we made our first money in 1929, and we kept on increasing every year. And during the Depression, we showed our first progress, growth, and profit.
In the Depression years, you continued to show increases in sales each
year? Yes, every year.
So that radio was actually going against the economic stream at that time.
Yes, it was. And I always thought I was very fortunate to have been lucky enough to get in the business.